Welcome to the Modern Homesteading Podcast.
We have allowed ourselves to become so disconnected and ignorant about something that is as intimate as the food that we eat.
Be prepared to grow your own for victory.
God said I need somebody strong enough to clear trees and heave bales, yet gentle enough to yean lambs and wean pigs and tend the pink foamed pullets, who will stop his mower for an hour to splint the broken leg of a meadow lark. So God made a farmer.
Hello and welcome to the Modern Homesteading Podcast. I'm your host, Harold Thornbrough, and glad you're joining me again today for this episode. Today we're going to dive into the topic of weeds in the garden. I have guest John Moody on today, and if you're spending much time in your garden, you might be finding that it's weeds are a challenge, and it's something that can eat up a lot of your time. It can actually make gardening kind of miserable if you don't know how to manage those weeds properly. So John's going to share with us a few tricks. He's actually got a book on the topic. So we're going to dive into some of the things that he has learned over the years of gardening and that he shares in his book. And it's kind of a long podcast today, so we're just going to jump right into it. I'm not going to prolong it and talk about my homestead and stuff. We're just going to jump right into it because he and I, we're friends. We talk about all kinds of things in the podcast. So there's a lot of other discussions other than just weeds. So we'll cover a lot of the things around our own personal homesteads in the podcast. So with that, let's just jump right into this episode with John Moody. Joined today on the podcast by John Moody. Now, John's been on a couple other times talking about his book, and we've talked about some we talked about elderberry. I think we talked about frugal homesteading once. So John's no stranger to the podcast. But, with that, John, welcome to the Modern Homesteading Podcast.
Hey, it's great to be back.
Well, I always enjoy talking to you. We talk other than this podcast every once in a while online and stuff, so it's always we have a lot of things in common, so it's always like talking to a friend for sure when I have you on the podcast.
Yeah, great to hear from you again. It's been great to see what you got going on this year on your homestead.
Yeah, it's an adjusting year for me. We're moving a lot of things around and changing some stuff because we, when we got the new property, we're kind of moving a lot of things around, trying to blend it all together and make it a little bit more like one big property instead of two separate properties. So we've been working on that a lot. So it's kind of cut my garden back this year because of the transition. But I figure we're gonna have 1 or 2 years of that, and then it's just gonna really flourish. So that's what we're hoping for. But for those for the folks who haven't maybe heard you on before, can you give us like the quick elevator pitch of just kind of who you are and what you do?
Oh man, so
is there such a thing?
I'm the world's least likely homesteader. So I grew up in the Lower West Side of Youngstown, Ohio. City kid, video game playing, junk food eating, cartoon watching. So did a little bit of hunting and other stuff because my dad forced me to as a kid. We ended up out on land, guess about a decade ago now. So I started doing crazy things like worm composting and growing food even when we lived in an apartment up in Louisville, Kentucky. So it drove my landlord and some of my neighbors absolutely crazy. Because I was the crazy guy, like it'd be like 10 at night and I'd wait till all my neighbors were no longer going down to do laundry and I'd sneak down to feed my hidden worm bins. And so, neighbors be like, what's going on down here in the basement of the apartment building? So,
that's great.
Yeah, so we've been, homesteading and farming for about a decade. And through that, I, had so much interest in some of the ways we were doing things. And I'd gotten an opportunity to speak at a couple conferences years ago. I started out speaking more on health and nutrition and traditional foods and stuff, and slowly have kind of transitioned to speaking more about, farming and raising food and all those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. How many books have you written now? 4 or 5?
I guess technically 6. Especially like in farming and homesteading type stuff.
Yeah.
So, because when I was in college, I wrote a couple math books, but those aren't generally something most people are looking for.
I don't know if this audience is going to run out and want to get those real quick, I know. I've seen several that you've written. I know you got the Frugal Homesteading book. You've written the one on elderberry. The one we're going to talk about, I think, mainly today is the weeds, War on Weeds. You've written one on sourdough bread. You and your wife put that out, I think?
Yeah, so I volunteered her for that.
That's nice of you.
any time I'd post, on social media, sourdough stuff my wife was making, all these people are like, oh, I want to do sourdough, or, oh, I tried sourdough, and this went wrong, and that went wrong, or the thing we heard most often from a lot of people was they just never figured out how to, like, manage their sourdough in the midst of real life. So, and my wife is just amazing because we have 5 kids, we homeschool, we travel some. So our schedule's pretty crazy. It's not like we have a simple life to try and do sourdough around. And she just made a really great system for managing and doing sourdough that basically anyone can use. And that just, allows us to consistently make sourdough stuff with no fuss or drama.
Yeah, just keeping starter going all the time. Just always have some just growing and ready to go, huh?
Yeah, well, and what she did, which I guess, not a lot of other people do, because it seems from, when she started teaching, but like a lot of people with their starter, they're like constantly having to discard starter, I guess. So they're constantly throwing away starter. And what my wife does with the schedule she made for doing sourdough is you're always feeding the sourdough to the amount you need for the next time you're cooking. So you get rid of all this waste and kind of all this complication at the same time. And we get yummy sourdough. My poor wife never does, because she's been gluten free, I think, for like 14 years.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So she puts in all the work and gets none of the joy. That ain't really fair, but that's all right, I guess.
and that's what I said about, they wanted to put my name on the title of the book with her. And I was like, all I did is like type what she told me to type for the most part.
And taste the bread for her, make sure it was good.
Oh, yeah. I did a lot of taste testing for that book.
Well, did you gain some weight, I wonder?
No, not during the book. So gaining weight is definitely the goal for this year. But not from, it's, at least for me, carbs don't really cause me to gain weight like they do for some people.
Yeah. It does me. Yeah, for sure. I have to really watch the carbs because it'll pile on me. It used to not be that way, and then that metabolism turned around, and then you just, like, you really got to watch it,
No.
I drive a truck for a living, too, so I sit a lot, so you're not after burning those calories off. You got to be careful what you're putting in.
Yeah, see, I'm very fortunate that, writing means I have a certain amount of sitting.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never had a true, desk job, or a sit job.
Where you just can't get up and do what you want to do,
You might find this interesting, though, but my dad was a truck driver for, 20-some years.
Hmm.
So I know a fair bit about the life of a truck driver, because it was the life my dad had for a really, really long time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's long hours. I mean, it's not a hard job, except for it's just long hours. It's what makes it hard. It's, you're dealing with a lot of the pressures of the road, of course, the stress of that. But, as far as the physical labor part, it's not real physical job, but it can stress you out, and it's a lot of hours. Most people are working 40 hours a week, and truck drivers, the standard hours are, 70 hours a week. So,
man.
Yeah, it can.
So how has that impacted you homesteading? Has it made it a bit more difficult with that particular job?
Well, I've had to definitely manage my time better. Now, I'm home on the weekends, so I can definitely do the bigger jobs on the weekend. I've done podcasts about it before, and I generally, maybe half hour to an hour a night, doing the homesteading chores and whatnot. So it's not real bad, and then I just really make up for it on the weekends. So my weekends are like really, really busy, trying to get everything caught up and done.
Yeah, I can just imagine. So we're going to be gone for like 10 or 11 days this fall. And I'm just like, trying to figure out how that's going to work.
Yeah, there's definitely challenges to it. But, I still find plenty of time to do, plenty of family things. And I watch a fair amount of TV and things like that, too. So, it isn't like all I do is work all the time. I mean, I don't know. And somehow you work it out and you find that extra time. I don't know. I don't really run like a schedule. I don't have like a, you know, all my time labeled out for this and that. I just kind of let it go as it goes. And I just got a routine that I've been doing. I've been driving a truck, I think, for 25 years now, 26, something like that. So I've gotten used to it.
Good.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about with you today, the weeds thing. You know, I mean, you wrote this book a while back. Several months ago, you put this book out, didn't you? I mean, it was back like last summer, maybe, or back last winter. I don't know. It was a few months ago, wasn't it?
It was the end of last summer because it came out about the same time that the Elderberry book came out. Because I did the two projects kind of at the same time, so I could take a break when one was driving me nuts.
Yeah. I know the Elderberry, I'm sure it was a great success, book, a great book, and, you know, just a great topic. A lot of people are really, you know, really interested in that. We've done a whole podcast on that, and it was definitely one of the more downloaded podcasts that I had. So a lot of people were very interested in knowing more about, you know, growing elderberry and what you could do with it and stuff. But I know a lot of people are struggling with weeds, you know. I mean, this morning, I got up early this morning, and I was after pulling weeds like crazy out of my garden. But I think you talk a lot about being more proactive on the weeds before you plant the garden, right? I mean, you really deal with that in a lot of detail, don't you?
Yeah, you know, like, so the reason I ended up writing that particular book is similar how, like, I got talking about soil for, you know, homesteaders and growers is when we purchased our land, I usually joke, though it's absolutely true, that I was the first person to ever buy a farm, soil not included. And so, you know, I borrowed a tiller from a neighbor because that's all I knew at the time. You know, you want to put in a garden, you got to till the soil. So I borrowed a tiller from my neighbor and the tiller broke before our soil did. It was just, you know, we have our base natural soil is like less than half a percentage organic matter. And it's on top of solid limestone rock in some places, just a few inches below the soil.
Yeah.
And so, it's just, you know, I was so stubborn the first year or so we were on our property that I grew in cardboard boxes. So I have these pictures from back in, you know, 2011 or so of me growing in cardboard boxes. Cause I was just so annoyed that, you know, we spent all this money and we bought, you know, 35 acres. And I can't grow anything. It's like moonscape.
Yeah, I laugh at that, but I've seen a guy growing potatoes in corn in cardboard boxes in his field because that way he could like fill the dirt up in the boxes per potato plant, and that worked out really well for that guy.
It does. It's actually really, you know, the way we grow some crops now isn't all that different. Mm-hmm. Basically making, you know, raised swale furrows to do a lot of crops in because it's so productive and it does just like eliminate certain complications and problems.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I learned how to build soil first because I didn't have any soil. And so I used to give this talk at the Mother Earth News Fairs called 6 inches of soil in 16 months.
Mm-hmm.
Where I talk about how you can build 6 inches of fantastic soil basically in a little over a year. So that after that, then you can grow, you know, just about whatever you want,
right?
Regardless of where you're starting. And so we started building all this amazing soil. So we just have like all this amazing soil to grow in. I think we're up to, you know, almost maybe 40,000 square feet. So, just under an acre between annuals and perennials. But, you know, the problem of soil gave way to the problem of weeds.
Yeah.
You know, cause like some of the stuff that we use to build soil, contained all sorts of like nasty, unfriendly weed seeds.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, you know, probably like 4 or 5 years ago, probably about five. My kids were a little younger then, but, you know, we were basically coming out every day and having to spend like 20, 30 minutes a day, every single day fighting weeds, just everywhere there's weeds.
Yeah, that weird real fast.
Oh, yeah, you know, and obviously, like, the kids aren't happy about that. And you know, this is one thing I realized for a lot of homesteaders, you know, like adults will do really, really dumb things that kids won't tolerate. And so you won't even realize how dumb it is unless you have a kid who loves, you know, who's around and is like, this don't make a lick of sense, Dad. like, you know, so kind of like with soil, we spent basically, you know, a year or so really kind of like figuring out why do we have weeds and how without chemicals and without tillage do you beat weeds,
mm-hmm,
without resorting, you know, to nasty chemicals or constantly destroying your soil structure by tilling it up. And so we cut the amount of time we spent weeding in the course of about a year and a half, probably by over 90%.
Wow. Yeah. That's a big, that saves a lot of time. That's a big difference.
Yeah. And you know, so like we can grow so much now with so little labor, you know, 'cause like this year we're actually getting ready to move. So we didn't have a single animal in, you know, come January, we had gotten rid of all our animals. We had basically buttoned all the infrastructure on the homestead and farm up to get ready to move. You know, over the last like 9 months, my wife got rid of about half of all of our worldly possessions. you know, so, and then, you know, all this madness that has been this year happened. So it made moving impossible.
Yeah.
And so it was like end of March, early April. So we decided we needed to have a growing season and raise animals this year after all. And so we went from, so when you look at like pictures on my Facebook page, we basically did everything you see in 60 days.
Wow. Yeah, I've seen some. It's coming along really well. It's very well established garden. You'd never know that it was that recent that you decided to pursue that again.
Yeah, and that's the nice thing is like once you get good systems and good infrastructure and good ways of managing things, you know, like with weeds, it's so much less work and so much more productive and just so much more enjoyable. But with weeds, you know, weeds are generally an afterthought for most people, and you know, they get them and then they get into trouble and then they're like, like, how do I fix this? Oh no.
Well,
so
I mean, you brought in the soil and it obviously had a lot of weed seeds in it. So can you give us just a couple of things that you that worked for you that you did?
So you know, there's basically like five or six great tactics,
mm-hmm,
that you can use to radically reduce, you know, the amount of weeding you're going to have in a growing space. And some of them are tactics you use during the growing season, alongside or like in between your plant rotations.
Mm-hmm.
And some are techniques you can use, you know, outside of growing season. And so, you know, right now, 'cause we're going into the summer solstice, if you're somebody who's getting ready to turn over crop beds, or you're going to have some beds that are fallow,
mm-hmm,
'cause you're going to be harvesting out your garlic, you're going to be harvesting out your potatoes, but it's too early to put in fall crops and too hot.
Right.
So you're going to have this space. You could solarize those spaces. And so solarization is one of my favorite techniques because it lets you kind of in that summer pause where it's really too hot to be growing or replanting things, it lets you use that pause to radically and permanently reduce the weed load, you know, in a better spot in your garden or, you know, on a larger plot of land.
So, yeah, you're doing that with tarps or plastic, or what are you using for that generally?
Yeah, so solarization, just so like listeners are clear, it is, you know, have you ever like laid a window down on a, mm-hmm, section of grass in your yard?
Oh yeah.
You know, you just
yellow.
Had an old window laying around, you threw it somewhere in the yard, and you come back a few days later and that spot is basically, you know, burned to a crisp. That's what solarization is, but instead of using, you know, windows, you use greenhouse grade clear plastic.
Okay. Now I've seen some people recommend using like a black plastic or a blue tarp or something like that. Is that something different in solarization? What is that?
Yeah, so that is occultation.
Okay. Just heating up the ground more than anything.
Well, actually, the black tarp does not warm up the ground almost at all. So we'll kind of be technical for a moment. So occultation, you know, in the winter, it will lightly warm the ground. And occultation works. So occultation is a technique. You can do it anytime, but it's an especially good technique to do to plots during off season.
Okay.
So, you know, you harvest out all your garden crops, you know, late October to early November, depending on where you are in the country. And you have this bare ground. You know, I go through both for solarization and for occultation with a push mower. And I mow it very thoroughly just to reduce anything that might puncture a tarp.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just to make kind of a nice, really clean, you know, reduced residue surface. So I'll pass over it two or three times with a push mower, with the deck getting lower each pass. And then with occultation, you'll spread a black tarp, and black is preferred because it, especially in the winter, it does warm the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens in occultation, though, is you're just going to, and with both of these techniques, you need to make sure the soil is adequately moist. Because both techniques need adequate soil moisture to be effective. So if you need to, you'll add water to the soil. And then once the soil is adequately moist, with both techniques, you spread either for solarization a clear tarp or for occultation a black tarp. So the one thing is the prep work for both these techniques is basically identical. You know, preparing an area that's mowed down and clear of anything that can, you know, damage the tarps, and making sure they have sufficient moisture in the soil. But then once you spread the tarps, they work completely differently. So in occultation, the tarp will warm the soil slightly, especially in, you know, winter time. And that will cause seeds, you know, that are in the top inch or so of the soil to germinate.
Mm.
But what happens is they germinate, and it's like a horror movie for plants.
No sunlight, they germinate, so.
Yeah, and then there's no air.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So in both of these techniques as well, another common mistake is you want the tarps as tight against the ground as possible, which is partly why mowing is so important to get that, you know, get that good ground contact. Because if the tarps are loose in both techniques, it really reduces the overall effectiveness. So in occultation, stuff will germinate and it, you know, comes up in a, you know, there's very little oxygen under the tarp. There's no sunlight under the tarp. So stuff germinates and then it just dies. And so it does a really, really good job of helping reduce what's known as the soil seed bank. You know, which is basically the fact that like every handful of soil contains, you know, hundreds to sometimes thousands of seeds built up over, you know, forever and ever. And so in occultation, you know, it gets a bunch of those seeds to germinate and then die. And as long as you don't go back through and till or otherwise turn up lower layers of the soil, you know, occultation done well can reduce weed pressure by a solid, you know, anywhere from 50% to 80% in a bed. And, you know, you can also do occultation repeatedly in a particular bed. So, you know, Curtis Stone, who's a pretty famous, you know, one is Curtis is just a great guy, but he's a very, very good farmer. And I think he was one of the people who popularized flame weeding beds, you know, after occultating. So instead of having to wait real long for stuff to die, you know, in that technique, you're tarping the bed like for occultation, but instead of waiting for stuff to grow and then die under the tarp, you pull the tarp and you kill it with a flame weeder.
Oh, yeah, get them to germinate and then kill them. You don't use the the tarp or the plastic to kill it. Just kill it quicker. Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, this is actually a fairly old farming technique, creating what are known as like stale or false seed beds. This is where if you do, you know, if you need to kind of improve the soil structure a little bit, you can go through a bed and you can lightly cultivate it.
Mm-hmm.
So just another good thing for listeners who may not understand the difference in tillage, the difference between cultivation and tillage is depth. So in tillage, you're generally going 4 or more inches deep into the soil. In cultivation, you're generally staying, you know, 3 inches and less, but really usually more like, you know, 2 inches or so,
mm-hmm.
just hitting that top of the soil. In cultivation. And so, you know, what a lot of people do now is they'll cultivate a bed or an area, they'll tarp it because that cultivation turns up a lot of the seeds that are just in the top layer. And then they'll take the tarp off, you know, after about 30 to 45 days when they have a lot of good germination. And then they go through and you can either flame weed it or you can cultivate it a second time.
Okay.
And then you can retarp it, and then you can do it again. And, you know, 2 rounds of that done properly, you know, creates a great, great, just a really great area for a wide range of crops.
Okay. So say 30 to 45 days for that way. Now, what about for solarization? Is it, how long does it take to do that?
Yeah. So with solarization, you know, with occultation, you might gently warm the soil. With solarization, you are basically creating a giant sun-powered microwave.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal in solarization isn't to get things to germinate. It is to drive up the temperature of the soil to the point where it completely kills plants, certain pests, certain soil-borne pathogens, mm-hmm. And it sterilizes a wide range of weed seeds. While they're still in the soil.
You know, I've looked into solarization a lot for the weed control, but what you just said there, I've never considered. I mean, there's a lot of like grubs and things for these beetles that live a few inches down, and it would kill those as well, I guess, huh?
It can, depending on how you do it and how long you do it. You know, for grubs, you know, especially things that have that soil larva stage.
Yeah.
The ideal method for dealing with those is to apply beneficial nematodes.
Nematodes, yeah. I was just wondering, you mentioned, you know, killing insects and things with the solarization. Mm-hmm. I think they generally go down a little deeper, though, probably, so it probably doesn't affect them as much.
Yeah, and it really depends on the pest, you know, because, like, solarization, yeah. I love doing it after my brassicas, so cabbages, mm-hmm. kales and things.
Yeah.
Because if any of the, you know, worm that attacks those crops happens to make it, you know, for whatever reason, they drop into the soil and make it to that reproductive stage because they're not very deep. You know, solarization can really help break some of those pest grub cycles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it can definitely help. Like, there's places in California where they've done studies where they'll use a technique called biosolarization, where they'll rip open the soil, you know, 12, 16 inches deep, and they'll incorporate huge amounts of uncomposted material into the soil. And then they'll water, and then they'll tarp it, and then you get solarization plus composting.
Yeah, it would actually just speed up the composting process a lot, too. Break that heat up really fast and really cook it in there, yeah.
Oh, and you know, if you have really, really bad soil, you want to put in like an organic orchard or something else like that, it's a fabulous way to quickly improve soil, get rid of a lot of disease and pest pressure,
mm-hmm.
and get rid of your weed problems all at the same time.
Now, I know some people worry about solarization, that it kills off like good microbes and, you know, microbiology in your soil. Is there a fear of that, or does it go down deeper? I mean, you're really only affecting a few inches down. It's not really, I mean, soil's pretty insulative thing. I mean, it's probably only going maybe 3, 4, 5 inches down with the heat. It's not really affecting anything deeper than that, is it?
Yeah. So the studies that have been done on it generally show that solarization is not, overly damaging to the soil food web.
Mm-hmm.
So you talk about, larger things that live in the soil, like earthworms and other stuff.
Yeah.
They get out of the way.
Right.
And they're going to move to adjoining patches and stuff. And a lot of bacteria that are beneficial in the soil can survive being heated up. So overall, I think the evidence shows that there are a few beneficial species of soil bacteria that don't do real well with solarization, but you can easily replenish those, just by making some compost tea or something else.
Yeah.
And after you solarize, go through and spray.
Yeah, I would think that it would have a pretty big effect on probably the fungal parts of the soil, but you could actually re-inoculate with that with a mushroom compost or something, I would think, to kind of boost that back when you're done.
Yeah, see, I've never, at least for us, so I generally use solarization as one step.
Mm-hmm.
And then my solarization is usually followed by either cover crops or mulching.
Mm, yeah.
So these are our other favorite techniques.
Yeah.
So we're in the middle of getting all of our sweet potatoes out. And so I had this big area that was cilantro and some other cool season greens. And we harvested and sold a bunch of those. And it's gotten too hot for them, so they're all going to flower and bolting on me and whatnot. So that area, we were finally ready. It finally got warm enough to put the sweet potatoes out. So we solarized it. And as the sweet potatoes go in, they go into little mounds. And then the entire area is buried under 4 to 6 inches of wood chips.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's a good method. I mean, a lot of people, have seen the Back to Eden movie and they're doing that style. I do use some wood chips, but I grow more like a square foot method. I mean, I really pack my bed so full of vegetables and things that I want to eat that I get weeds, but they're here and there instead of just, real thick because there's, you can't see the soil. Everything is so packed in there and growing so tight together. There's really no room for weeds to grow, too much in those areas. I have some beds that are a little more open, like tomato beds are a little bit more open, peppers, things like that. They're a little bit more spread across, but there's actually some weeds I let grow in those beds, like purslane. It stays low.
Yep.
As long as you keep it low, I don't worry about it. It's almost just like a cover crop underneath the tomatoes or underneath the peppers that doesn't affect them. I just let it grow. And then I use it in my salads. So it's kind of a double benefit.
Yeah. And that's, we had some people out on the farm a few weeks ago because we were doing some some intro gardening classes. And they were amazed that underneath my rows of peppers, it's a mixture of clover, lamb's quarter, mm-hmm. and purslane.
Yeah.
And we've been eating out the purslane, and as soon as it looks like it's going to go to seed, we generally won't let it go to seed on us.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Just because we have so much of it and there's only so much purslane a family of seven can eat.
I don't worry too much about the purslane. The lamb's quarter, if you let it go to seed, it can take over. I've definitely had that to own a spot.
Yeah, lamb's quarter is another one where we try and make sure. The nice thing is with lamb's quarter, though, is in my experience, and this is one thing I talk about in the book, is understanding how to prioritize weed species.
Because
mm-hmm. At least for us, lamb's quarter basically will never go to seed until the really late summer, but more generally the early fall.
Yeah.
Whereas purslane for us, we had purslane wanting to seed already, 3 or 4 weeks ago in the high tunnel.
Yeah, I have some out here that's already looks like it's going to seed. So, yeah, I understand. It goes quick, yeah.
Yeah, and so with purslane, we already have so much purslane pressure. We're like, yep, we're going to kind of stay on top of that one this year.
Yeah.
Eat a lot of it and knock it back.
But clover's way, too. Clover can get really tall if you let it. I mean, not real, real tall, but, I mean, it can definitely overtake plants and stuff if you let it get too thick and too tall. I mean, it can definitely overcome some things.
Yeah, well, that's where we use clover, especially with, are tall growing crops.
Mm-hmm.
So our peppers, our tomatoes, and there's a really useful tool. It's a hand scythe. So instead of, you know, having this really, really large scythe that you can go through and cut down an area, a hand scythe is, you know, about, you know, it's an 8-inch curved blade. So much, much smaller, much, much easier to handle. And what we'll do for those kind of living understories of red and white clover is, until the plants are tall enough, you know, every few weeks we just run through and I hand sigh carefully down around the plants.
Yeah.
You know, only takes me to do an entire row of peppers or an entire row of cucumbers or something. Probably doesn't even take me 10 minutes, to get it to drop back down and not be a nuisance to the plants until they get a little taller.
Yeah. I've definitely, used a lot of lower plants, you know, like I'll run a lot of squash or something underneath tomatoes and around peppers and, you know, along things that are taller and let those leaves just kind of cover up the ground as well. I mean, no doubt about it, bare soil, it will cause you problems because if you don't fill that space, nature will, for sure.
Yeah.
It'll put something there.
Yeah, and that's something then we'll seed, you know, and then you get on that cycle, just the endless weed cycle. Yeah, you know, so after solarization or occultation, you know, we do also do very, very tight planting. So, you know, a lot of people, kind of the way they orient their planting, you know, like parallel rows.
Yeah.
You know, like that always just baffled me because I'm like, there's a hole in between each set of plants. So, you know, all of our planting patterns are offset rows. Because then you can move the rows a couple inches closer together.
Yeah.
And since most plants grow in like a semicircular shape, they you know, eat up that empty space.
Yep.
So there's some really simple stuff you can do like that for, you know, first time growers that not only let you pack more into a space,
so
but
you're
also
talking, hold on, you're talking more like a, instead of going straight rows, more like a zigzag in your rows. Is that what you're kind of talking about?
Well, the row,
a slight
well, in
offset.
The row, it's, yeah, in the row itself, it'll be straight.
Okay.
But
okay.
Say, you know, say I'm doing cabbage. Instead of doing two rows of cabbage where the cabbage are right next to each other in two rows, we'll do three rows of cabbage.
Okay.
And the outer two rows will be the same, but the inner row will be halfway in between.
Yep.
Filling that hole.
Yeah.
That you would get from between the outer row. And it fills in so nicely.
Well, John, where are you gonna walk now? You just took out your path.
Well, you know, I mean, for cabbage and stuff, you don't need to walk in the cabbage because you know you just harvest at the end of the season, and then you harvest the biggest heads on the outside first, and slowly kind of work your way through the bed.
And if you don't have weeds, you don't need to be in there. Right.
Well, and that is the nice thing, you know, when the cabbage are small. The, you know, the couple times you need to weed, and you know, and we use tight planting patterns for things like cabbage in conjunction again with, you know, rotted wood chip mulch.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, so like between the mulch and the tight planting pattern, we'll have very little upfront weeding. And then by the time the cabbage begin to fill in, they completely shade everything for the most part. And it makes, you know, really easy to manage beds.
Yeah, yeah. So let's just, on the practical side, so say you're going to empty out some beds here. Say something's ready to harvest this next weekend. You're going to clean out a bed, a whole row of something. What's your next step? What are you going to do? Are you going to do anything if you're not ready to plant anything in there right away? What is going to be your step this next weekend if you're cleaning out a bed to prepare that bed to keep it weed-free for the next crop?
Yeah, well,
are you going to go with occultation, or are you going to?
Yeah, well, you know, this time of year, especially because since last year we were getting ready to move.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I basically let my kids do whatever they wanted in the garden. And so that did not involve them keeping on top of, you know, keeping the few weeds that did come up in check.
Yeah.
So this year we have a lot more weed pressure than we have had, you know, in a very long time. So this year, every time a bed turns over, it gets solarized.
Okay.
So because I really want to knock back that soil seed bank some.
And how long will you leave that plastic on there?
It all depends on when I need to plant.
Okay. So you just leave it on until it's ready to plant, basically.
Well, I usually won't leave it on more than, you know, with solarization, I generally won't leave it on more than 14 days.
Okay. Okay.
You know, but there's a bed, I think it was yesterday. Yeah, it would have been yesterday morning. So I'm walking around a bed right now as we talk that I mowed yesterday morning, and I spread the tarp on yesterday, and it was a solid sea of green, you know? So this is, it's probably like a 30 by 20 foot area, somewhere in that ballpark. And already since yesterday morning, everything under the tarp is yellowed or brown. It's just, you know, so 36 hours, and that was, you know, today was a mostly cloudy day. We were supposed to get rain, and we were always a bridesmaid, never a bride today.
I noticed that too. I'm going to have to water when I get off this podcast, matter of fact.
Yeah, we're just about into drought, unfortunately. So I think the USDA drought map has our part of Kentucky now listed as at risk for this year because we're so low on rain for the past 3 months. So, but you know, that's one of the benefits of mulching and tightly planting because you hold in the moisture so much better. You don't get nearly as much stress and evaporation for your plants.
This heat wave we're having, the lack of rain, I planted a bunch of small trees this year, and, you know, that's not ideal for new trees, so I've been trying to really put the water to them, you know, here the last couple of weeks. So I'm hoping that they weather this all right and make it, because I know this next week even, we got like some 90-degree temps and no rain in like the next week at least. So that's tough on them. I mean, I got mulch on them, but it's still really hard on young trees. I mean, these things are only like a foot and a half tall, you know, so it's really hard on them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's where, you know, mulch for trees, you know, drip irrigation or something else, soaker hoses or something to make your life easier.
Yeah. I got them sort of spread apart, you know, I got them kind of spread apart and then just kind of all over the yard. So it's like, yeah, I'm just having to really get out there. I'm just taking buckets and just saturating them every night. It's really all I can do.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, so like we'll solarize most beds this summer, just to kind of get them back to homeostasis if we end up not being able to move later in the year or until next year, just so that, you know, nobody knows what's going to happen anymore.
Yeah, it's in the air, that's for sure.
Yeah, you know, so we're going to solarize everything back, and then it will just really depend on what we're going to do with that particular bed come fall. You know, where we go next after solarizing it. You know, some of the beds I might cover crop, you know, so I might put some of the beds into buckwheat, or some of the beds into a clover or something.
Yeah. And then you just cut that down and plant when you're ready, huh? Just before it goes to seed.
Exactly. You know, so like some of that stuff, you know, like, there's some cover crops that will frost kill. So if we wait and plant them late enough, they'll grow. And then, you know, the first hard frost will kill them off. And then, you know, I'll just come through and mow them. And you know, this is where you can, you know, if you get a good stand of, you know, oats or some other cover crop, you can basically grow your own mulch right in place. So we've done that a couple years where I've put in sections of the garden into a really heavy, you know, grain type cover crop to improve the soil. And then, you know, it basically gets, you know, frost killed and then mowed. And then there's already a mulch to plant into for your transplants. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, really nice and kind of easy to manage and stuff.
Yeah, I've been, the last couple of years, I've just got bags of leaves, and it's really worked well for me. And because I have a lot of raised beds mostly, and in the raised beds, I've just filled them up with just like a thick, you know, pile of leaves, and I've put a tarp over that. And those really break down really good. And then I don't, you know, if there's a bunch left on there come spring, I'll just clean them off of there and then kind of start planting again, put some mulch down if it's not broke down real good or whatever. Because some of the trees I'll use, like I'll use a poplar tree or something, and those leaves don't break down real fast. So there'll be a lot of leaves still left on there, and it just creates this nice thick mat, and it's almost like an insulated tarp or something, you know, on those beds. And it seems to really, and then what little does break down, it just makes a great compost in there. But it does seem to take some weed pressure out too. But you just got to be careful where you get your leaves and, you know, where what you're putting on there. You know, you don't want to get a bunch mixed in with weed seeds or anything like that, you know, that you've raked up.
Yeah, well, and the problem, you know, and this is especially true for hay and straw.
Yeah.
It's less true for wood chips and leaves, but there are, especially for hay and straw, there's a number of persistent herbicides.
Yeah, the Grazon, I know, is one of them that will pass right through an animal.
Yeah, and you know, and once it's in your soil, it takes, you know, 4 or 5 years to break down.
Yeah.
And so it's one reason I really, you know, I like wood chip mulches versus straw or hay for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
I've never liked hay mulch. I know there's some people who swear by it, but, you know, every load of hay mulch is, you're bringing in just a gazillion weed seeds.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and I'm just saying, you know, I thought the goal was not to have a lot of weeds.
Yeah, I've experienced that. I've used hay before and you know, straw and things, and for some reason, the leaves have seemed to be the easiest thing to get a hold of and seem to work really, really well as far as just mulching, you know, for a winter mulch. You know, I do like the wood chips through the summer and stuff, but just for the winter, kind of like make this thick insulated bed on them. It just seems to work really, really well. So I've like using that, but I've got all new beds this year. I put all new soil in them, you know, and I bought soil and it had a lot of weed seeds in it. I've been doing a lot of weeding this year because, you know, I made this transition and built all these new beds and stuff. And it's been I was curious to talk to you about this because, you know, there's been a lot of weed pressure where I don't have things growing real thick together. And I do have a couple beds in my backyard that I left them empty this year. I just didn't do anything with them because I just kind of wanted to give them a rest because they've been pretty busy. And I didn't really want to mess with that right now. And weeds, I mean, it was bare soil and it's just completely filled with like thistles and just all kinds of really nasty, nasty stuff. And some of them were already starting to go to seed. Well, I didn't even take a chance. Like, generally I put a lot of weeds in the compost and stuff, but these things were going to seeds. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not even going to take a chance of that not getting hot enough. I just put them in trash bag and threw them in the trash because I'm just not going to mess with it or burn them or something. You know, I'm not even going to take a chance of that being in my compost.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I never feed weeds. I never put plant matter weeded out of the garden into my compost.
Oh, yeah? I do some things I do.
Yeah, and that's where, since we have pigs, anytime we do need to weed out an area, yeah. All of that material we feed to our pigs. And then all of the pig manure, you know, gets spread on pasture.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I just, like, for me personally, because it's so hard to get compost to ensure that, like, all parts of the compost pile get hot enough.
Yeah, yeah. It's a big chance you're taking if you throw them in there. Another thing, you know, I do with a lot of weeds, if I don't want to put them in the compost, and even if I don't see seeds in them or whatever, is just make a big batch of compost tea. We just shove it in a, you know, bucket and just get it soaking in some water and make a good compost tea out of weeds even. I've done a lot of weeds like that to make a compost tea, and then you strain it out real good, make sure there's no seeds or anything getting in the actual tea when you're done, you know. But that seems to work pretty well too. It's another way to make use of those. If you don't have pigs and rabbits and all those things that'll eat all those weeds.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that's where, you know, I don't, like, only time I'll burn stuff is if it has a disease issue or some other issue like that.
Yeah, you blighted know, tomatoes. I don't mess around with, like, tomatoes that got real bad blight. I don't put them in my compost or anything like that. I'd rather just burn those.
Yeah, so, yeah, you know, but, like, if you have beds that are going to be empty for a while, you know, I like, spreading leaves on the beds, making mm-hmm. sure there's enough water. One thing that might help you with the poplar leaves being slow to break down mm-hmm. Is some leaves are slow to break down because of the lack of calcium.
Oh.
So, you know, mixing in just a very, you know, a very small bit of powdered lime mm-hmm. Or something like that may solve some of your issues with the leaves not breaking down as quickly.
I guess I didn't really mind it. I mean, I just raked them off and put them back in the compost bin because they were partially broke down. And I just put them in the compost and kind of got the beds ready. It was all right. But, they're a leaf that does not break down fast for sure. I mean, like a lot of other leaves, like there's some leaves you put on there and they break down. Like I'll put comfrey leaves on my garden. Those things break down in just days, you know, and they're gone.
Yeah.
And, but you put like I said, a tulip poplar or something on there and it just set all winter long and part into the spring and it still didn't break down.
Well, or you know what else you could try that would be interesting is to cut a certain amount of comfrey leaf in with the poplar or other leaves.
Yeah, because it's generally used a lot of people use it as a compost starter to kind of get the thing going, you know. So, yeah, if you kind of mixed it in, yeah, that would probably work too.
Yeah, I feel like you'd probably get some really, you know, because leaves are so great for improving your soil.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, leaf mold, which is basically making, compost out of leaves by piling a whole bunch of leaves. Real easy to make. You can do it in like a cage, you know, just take some wire, make like a 3 foot wide cage, put a pallet in the bottom, fill it with leaves, let it rot down until spring. Might have to turn it once. Like leaf mold studies show is so good for improving soil quality.
Yeah, I've used it to actually make a bed soil, and I've used it instead of, you know, something else to make it more fluffy or whatever. You know, if you look like a Mel's mix, for example, some of the ingredients in that, I'll actually replace part of that with leaf mold, and it works just as well. It really gives it that fluffiness. It kind of creates it, you know, gives that little bit of fluffiness that leaf mold does.
Yeah, it's fabulous. So maybe comfrey will be your key to getting it to break down. You know, like in raised beds, you could just, you know, tarp over them until you're ready to plant.
Yeah.
So, because as you mentioned earlier, the one thing you just never want to have available is bare soil.
Right.
So bare soil is always going to be a problem.
Yeah, nature does not like it. It will do something with it.
You know, so if you don't have enough time to, you know, put a cover crop through that will, you know, accomplish some of the goals. You know, one of the big reasons I'm such a big fan of certain, you know, especially of clovers, is you can save so much money and avoid basically one of the most common problems homesteaders and gardeners run into with their soil if you'll grow clovers consistently along with or before or after certain plants. I do some soil consulting for some farmers and some other people, and a consistent problem a lot of homesteaders and gardeners run into is they use a lot of animal manures for fertility in their garden. And the problem is most animal manures are moderately high in nitrogen, but they're really, really high in phosphorus and potassium. And so somebody puts in a garden or whatever, and the first year, the garden does great. So what do? Well, they do what they did the first year again because, oh, well, it works so great for me, so I'm just going to do it again. And generally speaking, the second year, it still does really good. And then the third year, I get a phone call from them, or the fourth year, and they're like, my plants aren't yielding anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, well, have you done a soil test? And you know, a lot of times, no, they haven't done a soil test, because even though they're cheap and even though they're easy, it's still one of the most often neglected things. Even some farmers refuse to do is, you know, get a simple soil test to avoid problems. So you send them to go get a soil test and it'll come back and they'll have really, really elevated phosphorus and potassium levels.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, because, you know, manures are just always going to not give you enough nitrogen and give you too much phosphorus and potassium over time. And so a lot of people just create problems for themselves that way by relying so heavily on animal manures.
Yeah, I add a little bit of rabbit manure to beds, but I generally compost all of it, and I get a good balance, you know, of just, you know, there's, like I said, there's a lots of comfrey and grass and leaves and, you know, some rabbit manure, maybe a little, you know, I got quail manure as well, and put that in there. And I compost it for several months generally before I get it on the garden. This seems to really make a big difference, you know, I get more of a balance that way.
Yeah. Well, and you know, that's where I tell people, you really don't want to be overly reliant on any one, you know, soil building input for your ground, you know, for annual growing space. Pastures are different. And then orchards are a different, you know, animal as well. But especially for your annual growing spaces, learning to make, you know, nice, diverse soil building inputs will avoid a lot of problems.
Yeah.
Oh, because, you know, you'll find this story funny, but I had one lady who for years, she took like all of the bagged grass clippings from their yard and put it on her raised beds. You know, so this, you know, it's like a 25,000 square foot yard or whatever, you know, for two or three 70 or 80 foot raised beds.
Oh, wow.
And it totally, you know, because I believe grass is high in phosphorus. It totally jacked up the phosphorus levels in her soil in those raised beds.
But she didn't have any weeds, like, though.
Oh, yeah, she didn't have any weeds, you know, because. Because she was like, oh, I was using the grass clippings to mulch the bed so that, you know, it would keep weeds out. And I mean, you know, the phosphorus levels were, it was almost like you could mine. You know, it's like the level of phosphorus you would find in a rock phosphate mine.
Oh, wow.
Nothing was wanting
to grow well in that. Yeah, for sure.
Oh, yeah. It was crazy. Yeah. So
that take a lot to correct, too. I mean, just have to add the other stuff, try to lift up everything else and balance it out. I mean, that could take some time to get that back balanced out for sure.
Well, in a raised bed, what I told her that made her unhappy at first until she realized that she was going to have six raised beds instead of three raised beds is I told her to half the raised beds, take half of the material out and buy, you know, gave her a recipe for what to replace it with.
Start over.
It would be they basically would have no phosphorus.
Yeah. Wow.
And I basically said, like, there's no way you're going to get this phosphorus out. Like, it's here to stay. The only thing there's another lady who sent me soil test results. So this is the nice thing about raised beds. It's easier to fix a soil problem in a raised bed, because if you need to take out 20 or 30% of the material, you can move it to another part of your property. You can use it to amend soil somewhere else that might need those. You can use it to fertilize your lawn, and then you can just, you know, put new material into the bed and don't make those same choices again that led to that problem. Yeah.
It's not cheap, though. It's not cheap.
Yeah.
filling raised beds gets pretty costly. If you got a lot of them, it can definitely add up.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure. Well, and that's where I did a talk for the online Mother Earth News Fair about container gardening and talked about, you know, how to make more of your own mix and material.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because if you have space where you can get loads and loads of wood chips, you know, a lot of raised bed mix, basically rotted wood chips.
Oh, yeah.
You know, two and a half year old rotted wood chips. So if you want to do a lot of raised bed gardening and you have access to large amounts of wood chips, one of the best things you can do is, you know, just create a spot to age wood chips, you know, and if you want to age them faster, you can, you know, spray them with different things like a comfrey spray or something that will radically speed up their breakdown. And then you can make, you know, really large amounts of raised bed mix.
Yeah,
right,
I used
on
to
your
work,
homestead.
Like 15 years ago, I worked for a county highway department, and you know, you're constantly cutting, you know, trees off the side of the road, and they just had piles. I mean, they had this huge mountain of wood chips out there, and they never really done anything with it. And I would go in with that thing with the end loader every once in a while, stir that up because it gets a smoking, you know, because it gets so much heat and stuff, you know, from just composting. And I remember digging into that with that end loader, and it was just like the blackest, richest soil in the middle of that wood pile you've ever seen. That wood chip pile. It was just it was amazing. I thought, this is some good stuff, right?
But yeah, and you know, like this, you know, if you have reader, you know, listeners, I should say, who are, you know, because of everything going on, really want to do a lot more growing next year. But a simple thing you can do this summer is, you know, try and get a load of wood chips delivered to your place and start picking up some coffee grounds from a couple local, because like wood chips plus coffee grounds,
yeah,
just mix them together, make sure they get water, mix them once or twice. You could make, man, you know, a load of wood chips from one of the small chip trucks is usually about 4 or 5 yards of wood chips, a yard being 27 cubic feet.
Yeah. Is so that basically how you could, built the soil on your property? I mean, just using wood chips?
Well, I used a number of things.
Okay.
So we do worm composting. So we have those IBC water totes, those big 275-gallon cube totes. We actually do worm compost in those at that scale and size. So we basically use a mixture of, you know, targeted soil improving amendments like worm compost and compost, cover crops and mulches to improve the soil. So, you know, I said earlier, like when we moved here, our soil was less than 0.5% organic matter. And our last set of soil test results pegged our soil's organic matter at 21 to 32%, depending on where the sample was taken.
But you were talking about earlier building like 6 inches of soil in or something. Is that, I mean, just you're just talking mostly, probably do a lot of that with wood chips and just compost and things, right, is what you're really getting at as far as building it up, actually making the soil deeper.
Yeah, well, and again, like one of the best soil improvers that's absolutely free in most of the country and is available in large amounts is coffee ground.
Mm-hmm.
So if all you can get your hands on are wood chips and coffee ground, you could do amazing things to improve your soil.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll tell you something else. We talked about leaves earlier. If you can get a leaf mulcher, like one of them, they're like a barrel looking thing. You just drop the leaves in and it really mulches them up really fine. And if you have a lot of leaves, if you got places where you can get a lot of leaves, you can get a pretty good mountain of mulched up leaves. And that, once you mulch them up, they break down really fast.
Yeah. Are you talking like the thing that like basically shreds them nicely?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. One of my great sadnesses is I had a neighbor that had like an 8-inch gas powered chipper that he sold for only like $75 or $100.
Oh man.
And yeah. I found out after he sold it, cause I was like, that's my dream. I was like, I have so much shrubby brushwood and stuff. I would be chipping, you know, so much stuff that we have to burn off. I would be chipping.
Yeah, I have a little electric mulcher. I don't recommend those. It does like little limbs and stuff. I cut off a little of the trees, but wow, that thing jams up so easy and it's more of a pain. I mean, I use it every year because it's what I have, but yeah, the gas ones are so much better.
Yeah, you know, so I love mulches because you're going to save an incredible amount on watering needs, you know, especially as your soil improves. But we figure, wood chip, you know, rotted wood chip mulches reduce the amount of water we use probably by about 75% each season.
Oh.
And so when you're on a well, you know, that's a lot less wear and tear on your well pump and whatnot. Mm-hmm. If you're on city water, that's just a lot less chlorine and other junk, you know, you're putting down in your garden.
And a lot less money out of your wallet.
Yeah, well, that's the worst part because, you know, in the city, the thing I always forget is a lot of people, you pay the sewage side of your water, even if it's not going down the sewer system.
Yep, it is the more expensive part, too. If you ever look at a water bill, it's definitely the more expensive part.
Oh, yeah, you know, so it's, you know, a 75% reduction in the amount of water you need to use is a real substantial time and cost savings, you know, regardless of where you're getting that water from.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it just does such a great job of keeping weeds away. So, you know, you're building soil, you're stopping weeds, and you're saving on water.
It's all connected. I mean, you're doing the one, you're benefiting other things. It ain't, you know, we're trying to prevent weeds, but there's so many other benefits to all this. I mean, it just all works together and you end up with all of it working together and just making it better, you know, all the way around. Your garden will be better in every way when you do a lot of these things we're talking about.
Yeah. Well, and that's the goal is just like, I love growing things, but I love other things too.
Yeah.
And so,
you must spend all your time in the garden, huh?
Yeah. You know, so I'm always, well, and you know, people are always amazed at how little time we spend in the garden for how much we grow.
Yeah.
So we really try and have a very, very high, you know, basically I really want to be making $30 to $50 an hour in my garden.
And it's really about setting up the right infrastructure, getting it established. I mean, cause there is a lot of work at first getting it established, but once things are, you know, really clicking, then it just gets easier for sure.
Oh yeah. 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 You know, that first year or so, because you're learning and other stuff,
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to be as productive, but your goal should be, you know, to really look and see or go learn from people who have really, really productive systems in place.
Yeah.
And, you know, why they're productive and how they work.
That's why I just love YouTube and podcasts and things like that, because you just, you know, you watch these people, you listen to these people. And if you got some people local that you can go and actually talk to them, I mean, that's even better. I mean, you can get hands-on experience or see what they're actually doing right there. But all that stuff working together, I mean, it's just, you know, the online situation has a lot of problems, but it's there's a lot of blessings that come with it as well, for sure.
Yeah. Well, and that's, you know, like with a lot of the conferences and stuff canceled, We had people just be like, can you do some classes right on your farm? You know, you should do this. Like, you know, And so we've been doing just little 10-person classes that are like 3 hours people have just said. It's like, it's so great to walk through an entire system.
And you know what? There's probably people that'll come to something like that that would never go to the actual conference too. So it's probably benefiting even a lot more people in the end, or other people, you know?
Yeah. Especially people who like want a chance to really dive a bit deeper and discuss a bit, you know, really kind of see, you know, not just a 40-minute talk with pictures, but a lot of detailed information about how stuff works and why you do it this way and, you know, what about this and what about that?
Right. Yeah. There's so much to learn, but, you know, the best way to learn is just to get out there and start doing it. I mean, you can learn as you go. You can talk to people and you can learn things and have some failures. I've learned way more from failures than I probably have from other people even, and I've learned a lot from other people. So, I mean, just the best thing to do is just get out there and start doing it. You know, I just encourage people to just, you know, get started doing something, because it's not going to be perfect right off the bat. There's no way it's going to work. If it works out perfect for you, then you're a rare breed. But, you know, you just can't be afraid of it. You just got to start. I've talked to people who are just, they overanalyze and think about it and think about it and talk about it. And they don't do anything, you know, and it's like, just do it, you know, already put a seed in some dirt. Like, come on, go.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, like again, when we lived in an apartment, I was so inspired to start growing things that, you know, I started composting stuff in the basement of the apartment and I bought some of those earth boxes. If you remember, they were like a big fad, I guess, you know, late 1990s or early 2000s. So I bought some of those, and on my way to class in the morning, you know, I'd walk outside and water my earth box if it needed water, and I'd move it around the courtyard of our apartment building so that it would get the best sun possible until I came home. And then I'd get home in the afternoon, and all these people in the apartment building thought I was just insane. You know,
now they know it.
Yeah. Oh yeah, exactly. So, I'm good friends with Congressman Thomas Massey. And one of the things that most impresses me about him and his wife is even when they were at MIT together, they grew food. one of their life goals was to, no matter what, every single year grow things.
Yeah.
It's just such an inspiring thing, because, you know, if he can pull that off, anybody can pull that off.
If you can get one meal a week from your garden, that's one less meal, you know, that you're buying from the store or eating out at or whatever. I mean, it's just something, it's one thing, you know, and then you can just grow from there.
Yeah. For this online Mother Earth News Fair, they asked some of the speakers, how much money do you save per year homesteading? And so we kind of went through and we figured out, like, we save about $12,000 a year.
Oh, wow.
Just raising some pigs, raising some chickens, and growing a bunch of the produce we eat. Because, you know, we're a family of seven, and we can crush through, you know, 2 to 3 heads of lettuce, you know, as the salad.
You probably want to do some new math, because if you haven't been to the grocery store and seen the prices of stuff lately, I bet that number is bigger now.
Yeah, it might be. You know, it's been, we get so little at the grocery store because I run a local food buying club in Louisville, Kentucky, and then we just grow and raise so much.
Yeah, food prices are just getting crazy. I mean, they're really going up, which, you know, I mean, we've talked about that before, that really a lot of that stuff's been underpriced for so long. That's why people freak out when they have to buy a, you know, something that's raised in an organic way or whatever, or natural way, because it's so much more expensive than the stuff in the store. And so, yeah, that stuff's just been so underpriced for so long, really, that maybe that'll make people go, oh, well, I might as well just buy the good stuff if I'm going to have to pay that price.
Well, yeah, I was in Costco a couple weeks ago, and the you know, conventional bacon at Costco was $10 a pound and limit one.
It went up for sure.
Yeah. And I was just like, you know, the local Beyond Organic bacon that my buying club carries is $10.49 a pound. And there is no limit on how many packages you can get.
If people get an understanding of that, it's going to make some changes in some people's lives, because now if they can start comparing the prices and whatnot. But yeah, it's just it's some good motivation to start growing your own food, or even getting in contact with local growers that you can get the food from, because now's the time. I mean, I'm sure there's some minds being changed in all this, and some things being thought about that haven't been thought about before with a lot of people, you know, with their food and how far their food travels and what really goes into getting that food. I mean, there's a lot of bad going on. There's no doubt about it. But I think there's a lot of thinking going on that maybe should have happened a long time ago, too, you know?
Yeah, I think from the numbers I've seen, there is a record number of new gardeners in the United States
this year.
You're just millions of people. But like, you know, the people we had out to our farm for these classes so far this summer, I think over half of them had never really had a garden before.
Mm-hmm.
I'm amazed at the number of people who are being motivated to take some measure of responsibility for their families, you know, preparedness and security and food security.
Yeah, I hope a lot of them don't get discouraged when it doesn't, like, supply all their food the first year or something. You know, I think sometimes people go into it with some expectations that aren't realistic. Like, well, we're just going to grow our food, you know, and it's like, well, you're still, you know, we spent, you know, still 75% of what we spent at the grocery store, even after having a garden. You know, I think people sometimes come into it with some really high expectations, and it doesn't, you know, especially the first couple of years, doesn't turn out the way they want, and they, oh, this wasn't worth it, and then they bail out. And I hope we don't see that. I'm hoping some people will stick it out, realize that every little thing you do will eventually add up, and it makes a difference. It really does.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, have you figured out what one of your raised beds produces food dollar wise per year for you?
No, I really don't. I don't think about it. Like, I just try to eat as much as I can from the garden. I really do. I don't even do the math. I just eat everything I can from the garden and from, you know, livestock or whatever. I just want to eat as little outside of that as I have to. And I eat quite a bit outside of that, but, you know, I eat a lot from the garden, you know, and that's all I really know. I just try to eat as much as I can. Because I guess I would get a little discouraged too, maybe, because I don't have, you know, dozens of acres where I can grow, you know, I can just fill the pantry up completely and have enough of everything to get me through all year, every year. I can't think like that, you know, so I just eat as much as I can from the garden. I would say 60% of my food probably comes right off this property, which is pretty amazing considering the size of my property, I feel like.
Yeah, that's very impressive.
Yeah, I mean, I eat a lot from the garden and quail and rabbit and just that meat source, you know. I mean, it's a lot. I think probably on my meat, it's probably only like 20% of my meat comes from this property, but I would say it's probably in the definitely 50 to 60% on the vegetables, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, that's we can't wait to move to be able to grow more on the fruit side.
Yeah.
So we would love if we can take kind of like our very solid base in vegetable production.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have a fair bit of perennials as well. But we would really, really love to get to a property that let us do a lot more a lot more on the fruit side.
Yeah, it's something I've even expanded on, even on this smaller property. I mean, I've planted some pawpaw trees, and you know, I mean, I've already had pear and apple, and mulberry, and some things like that. And I put plums in, and peaches, and pawpaw, and almond tree, and just some things like that. I'm just trying to really expand, get a little bit more, you know, a variety in the fruit side of things, and then and ever expanding the berries and things like that, trying to grow more berries and things too. So yeah, I mean, I like the diversity, but when you do that, you don't grow as much of any one thing, you know. So it's like, yeah, when you try to make your property a little more diverse on what you grow, it definitely cuts down on big amounts of any one thing, and that can be a little difficult if you're trying to put food up for the winter, you know.
Yeah, well, and you know, one thing my wife and I were talking about the other night, because you know, some people come like, wow, you grow so much, and then some people come and they're like, why don't you grow more though? Because you have all this space or this or that.
Yeah.
And, you know, we try and balance, you know, being good at a few things with, you know, because like we could probably on this property, if we invested the money, probably grow 80% of all the food we needed for our family pretty easily. But the amount of time and energy it would take to do that would take away from, you know, our elderberry syrup business. It would take away from us doing judo and jujitsu. It would take away from church and things.
Yeah.
And so, you know, one thing I also encourage people is that balance.
That's something we did this year. I mean, I cleaned out, when I told you I made this transition, and kind of what I'm doing is I'm moving a lot of the beds up to the front, to the side of the property, and I cleaned out the backyard. I mean, I took out several of the raised beds out of the backyard, because we have grandkids and we want a place for them to play, and we put it, you know, I've got a swing set back there, and we, you know, have a little pool back there for them, and we got some grass to run in, and it was just a balance. You know, I said, I love growing things, but I'm growing more than vegetables. We're growing some grandkids around here, you know, and we want to have them come over and be able to play in the backyard and have a good time and just be able to run around and be kids, you know, and it was kind of a transition. I think a lot of people would look at that and say, well, you have that space back there. And I was like, yeah, I had that filled with vegetable one time, and we just kind of transitioned it over, and I actually probably have a little less growing this year than I did last year. I'm going to expand that out into that side yard over the next couple of years and get, you know, even have way more than what I had before. But this year I've actually got a little less than I had last year.
Yeah.
But that's okay. You know, it's a balance for us, and it's just something we decided that was better for the family, you know. Well, that was all happening before all this other tragedy happened in the world. Now I'm thinking maybe I needed the food worse, but, you know, I don't know.
Well, hopefully you have good, you know, you've probably built up some local food options as well.
Yeah, we do. We have some options there as well. Yeah.
Yeah, because that's the big thing, too, especially for new growers, is you're always going to have certain crop failures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, last year for us, our well went out. Our well sprung a leak, I think, early August. So the hottest, driest time possible is when the well decided to die, which means, you know, our stuff not in the high tunnel did fine, but everything in the high tunnel basically baked like chocolate chip cookies in a 450-degree oven.
Oh, man.
And so we lost our entire high tunnel. And you know, it's just like, stuff like that's going to happen. You know, you're going to have a crop overran by a pest you never knew existed, you know, or you're going to get a hailstorm.
Mm-hmm.
Or like this year, you know, one of the things that really broke my heart for new gardeners this year was, you know, back in February and March, yeah, you go by stores and they're already selling plants.
Yeah, everybody's popping out there and frost isn't even over yet. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and they're selling, you know, basil and other really, really sensitive plants in, like, March, you know, because there's – and then we get that, you know, we got a freeze.
Yeah, we did too, and I was doing everything in my power, and it worked. I mean, I did enough to save a lot of things. I took some chances, and I went early this year. I planted a lot of things early, and, I mean, it's paying off now, but I was worried about there for a few days. We had those really cold spells, and I was pulling every trick in the book out, and I saved it, but I didn't get any frost damage. I think I had, like, a couple things that got touched by it, but it wasn't bad. It was really mild, and I was surprised, because, I mean, I was actually covering things with row cover, with blankets, and I was taking like my electric seed mats and shoving in between the plants, you know, on the raised beds underneath there, trying to generate heat and have extension cords running everywhere and stuff. I was trying every trick I could to try to save them, because it got down to like, I think it got down, I think like low 20s, you know, a couple times during that.
Yeah.
It was, it was pretty touch and go there for a little while.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because here in Kentucky, that was 2 weeks after, I think, our frost date.
Yeah.
That hit. And I mean, and I think where we are, it got down to 28 or 29. Mm-hmm. So it was no bueno. It was not enjoyable.
I seen a lot of pictures on Facebook and such of folks who lost a lot of their crops, a lot of them. A good friend of mine, he had a whole, he has a high tunnel, and he had a field with tomato plants and lost dang near every one of them in the tunnel.
Did he try doing floating row cover or anything, or did he just kind of let it go?
He just thought it would hold enough heat, and he let it go, and it got him. It killed almost every plant in there. Yeah,
that's the thing. You know, tunnels, the amazing thing is how they do not actually hold heat.
Right, yeah. They will build up some heat through the sunlight, but they don't really hold it well. Unless you're taking extra precautions and doing extra things. But, yeah, he had bad luck with that. And he paid for it, but he knows now. Now he learned from his mistake. He's only had it a couple of years, so he's still kind of learning process of how to really use it good. but it got him pretty good.
Yeah, I only, I normally have about 600 or so feet of row cover on hand, but a lot of our row cover was kind of worn out at the, again, we're getting ready to move. So like, oh, all this old row cover, it's kind of a bit tattered and beaten. It's time for it to be recycled. We're not going to need it anyway. So I only had two new rows, two new 50-foot rolls of row cover on hand. When that frost came, and I was just like, where's all my row cover?
I went and bought some this year just for that, just because I knew I was taking some chances, because I was going out. I went and put everything out about 3 weeks before our last frost date. I took some real chances because I thought, I just really want to get a jump on this, you know. It's paying off now because we're getting quite a bit of food. But, I was really taking a chance. And I had the row cover ready. I was ready for it, you know. But still, it's kind of like a hope and a prayer, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, floating row cover is now, you know, it's kind of like one of those things you learn. You're just like, you know, having extra floating row cover on hand is probably never a bad idea.
Right. It can save you in a light frost. We got a hard freeze, though, and I was like, that scared me a little bit. I took every extra precaution on that one. I was just doing everything I could to try to build up a little bit of heat under those beds, and it turned out to be enough. It was surprisingly, I was the next morning, I'm out there peeking. You know, I didn't want to uncover anything, you know, because it's still cold, but I'm kind of peeking, see if anything looks brown or drooped down to the ground or whatever. And everything was all right, so it worked out.
Yeah, well, and you know, this might be useful for listeners, but I think it's like the 19 weight row cover.
Mm-hmm.
It is worth 5 degrees of protection.
Okay.
For each layer. So, you know, for that freeze, you know, stuff in our high tunnel, we protected with a single layer because the high tunnel is a bit warmer than outside.
Yeah.
And then outside stuff, needed a double layer to really be sure it would be well protected. So,
I took my most sensitive stuff. I had a row cover over it, and I was laying like some blankets even over that, like where my tomatoes were and stuff, trying to really thicken it up, you know, put some insulation on there.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, another thing you can do. So one of the things I did for our most sensitive plants, because I already had zucchini and stuff that were, you know, probably, you know, these are like 4 week old zucchini in the high tunnel. So they're getting ready to flower. They're getting that stage. We're going to be putting forth their first flowers and really zooming up. We filled, 20 gallon black totes with water a few days before the freeze and let them warm up. And then we had the totes, basically among the plants.
Yeah.
And then in my rows of peppers, I actually drained our hot water heater and some of our food grade, you know, food storage buckets that were empty that we have on hand. I filled with hot water and snapped lids on them. And I put those buckets of hot water underneath the row cover, you know, every so many pepper plants. So it'd be like four pepper plants, 5 gallon bucket of hot water.
Yeah.
And so we were able, and it was amazing because I have some pictures I posted on Facebook where there would be identical plants 6 inches apart from each other in our high tunnel. And the ones under the row cover were perfectly untouched. And the plants 6 inches away that weren't under the row cover were utterly ruined, just completely demolished.
I remember you sharing those pictures. I remember seeing that. Yeah, that's pretty interesting, isn't it, that it makes that big of a difference?
Oh, I was just amazed. Like, you know, it really, it really just is like some of the things we homesteaders and farmers have access to really are incredible. Like, just what a mercy and a blessing that, you know, for a $15 sheet of row cover, you can extend your growing season by 3 months and protect, you know, thousands of dollars of food and plants.
Yeah, yeah. It is amazing. If Paul Ingalls would have had access to those things back in the day, he wouldn't have been doing that show every year where his crops were failing.
That's funny.
Well, John, I think we've solved most of the homesteading problems in the world. I guess we can probably wrap this up. And but I appreciate it. You got some great advice for folks with weeds and, you know, keeping weeds out there. It's a huge problem. It's a huge problem for homesteaders. I mean, it's something that will eat up a lot of your time if you don't know how to handle it right. It's something that if you know a few tricks you shared with us today, I mean, it definitely can make all the difference in having a good year or a miserable year of just being out in the garden a lot. So I'm sure you have a lot more to say about that in your book, Winning the War on Weeds. So I'll put links to that and your other books in the show notes so people can check that out, because I'm sure there's some a lot more great advice in there for beating those weeds.
Yeah, hopefully it'll help people, because, you know, the general time of year that you have the most weed problems is also the best time of year to go to the beach. And so I want to be at the beach. I don't want to be pulling weeds, and I want to see you at the beach.
There you go. So, well, it can make, like I said, it can make you miserable if everything's going wrong and you're spending your whole weekend just doing that and you don't have any kids to make do it. So, like, I don't anyway, in the house, so I have to go out there and do it myself. So, I want them defeated. I don't want to deal with them.
I've learned, you know, making kids do weeding work is not a winning strategy.
Well, it'll make them grow up to not really want to garden, probably. So I know I did my fair share of it as a kid, and I kind of broke away from gardening for a few years. That might have had something to do with it. I'm not real sure.
Yeah.
I got all the worst jobs in the garden. I didn't get the fun stuff. I got the worst jobs.
we'll need to talk about that some other time. So, because that's a worthwhile episode in itself, how to homestead in a way that your kids will love it and want to do it.
Yes, yes. So. You know, that's our future. It's their future, and we want them to. We do a fair share of trying to convince people this lifestyle is worth living. It's sad if our kids don't want to do it, right?
Exactly.
So, yeah, we want to ensure that they have a love for the lifestyle. Well, John, it was really good talking to you tonight. I'll let you tend to your other duties, and I really appreciate you coming on the podcast tonight and sharing everything you did with us.
Great. Well, you have a wonderful night, brother.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. To learn more or find more episodes, just head on over to haroldthornbro.com. Thanks for listening.